You're now listening to the Talking Pictures Podcast, broadcasting from sunny Orange County, California. Filmmaker, journalist, and film historian, Paul Booth.
Aloha. Welcome to Talking Pictures with Paul Booth. So happy to be here today. As always, we are going to be joined by Mr. Faden Papamichael, ASC, GSC, which is American Society of Cinematographers, and GSC, Greek Society of Cinematographers. We're going to be discussing Ford versus Ferrari, the Ferrari. And as always, we'll dive into some of the artistic process, filmmaking process, hopefully some art, music, life, basically wherever our guest wants to go. This is directed by James Mangold, played the Toronto International Film Festival. You can check the trailer out. There's a few of them on YouTube and some really cool interviews with the cast, which includes Matt Damon, Christian Bale. This is the fifth film with James Mangold and Faden Papamichael as a cinematographer, of course. So, and they've made their mark with Walk the Line, Identity. Gosh, that was back when I was in college, so it had to have been 2002, 2003. And this looks like a really complicated film to make. And let's see, I think we have our guest calling in now.
Yeah, aloha, hi, Paul, welcome. Faden. Hi, it's Faden.
How's it going?
Good, good.
Jen, first of all, congrats. I'm watching the trailer and realizing that the story, not just a racing film, watching the trailer, I could easily think of McQueen's Le Mans. I saw some of the trailers with James Mangold going into some of the themes. I wanted to know from you, because there's so many synopses on the internet, what is the story about from your perspective?
Well, obviously, it's a movie about the event 1966 that leads up to that. That's the climactic finale for it. But it's a movie about friendship, about passion to pursue with almost this obsessive intensity what you love and what you believe in. It's about the underdogs, the people outside that don't function so much in the structure of things. It's about individualists dealing with corporate structure rules. So we have Ken Miles, who's always been a bit of a rebel, and as this, you know, in a way, brilliant but also dysfunctional personality who can really cope with authority, and then Carroll Shelby, who was a very successful driver. He was, I believe, the only American to win Le Mans in 1959, then had to retire because of a heart condition, and became an entrepreneur, and was an engineer, but really was also a sleek salesman, developed the Shelby, famous Shelby Cobras that he was selling successfully to hipsters. And in he had a workshop in Venice, California, and selling to people like Steve McQueen and lots of, affluent race enthusiasts. But he had to quit racing, and then so it's a friendship between these two guys that found themselves a bit on the outside, and how this fell came to them. And basically, Ford was trying to change their image. They were looking to enter international, not NASCAR, but like international high-profile racing, which was at the time the most prestigious event was Le Mans. And Lee Iacocca actually is the one who pitched the thing to Henry Ford II, the Deuce. And they go, well, Lee, this is never going to work. We can never develop a car that will beat Ferrari in this amount of time. And I mean, so he goes, well, let's just buy them. They're broke. And so they flew to Italy. They got very close to agreeing on a sale. But in the last moment, Enzo changed his mind. He wouldn't maintain full control of the race team. So he actually sold to Fiat, which left him with full control of his race car division. So, and they came back and told Henry Ford II, which upset him so much that he goes, I don't care what it costs, let me build a car that will bury these Italians at Le Mans, and that's when they approached Shelby and said basically carte blanche, do whatever you want, I don't care what it costs, build us a race car that will beat Ferrari at Le Mans, and so that's sort of a plot, but it's really, you know, then he goes to Ken Miles, is his friend who races Shelby's race Cobras successfully for him, and gets him involved because Ken Miles is also a great engineer, is a very intuitive, instinctive driver, and his feedback was very crucial to the development of this GT40. But you know, as with all Mangold films, whether it's Western or biopic or Copland or Heavy, this is my fifth movie with him. I mean, it's always very, he develops and nurtures really great characters. I mean, every single character in this film is beautifully developed. They're not really caricature, they're very emotionally connected. And even the action, I mean, this is, of course, we have pretty impressive race car action scenes, but the key is always to stay connected to the driver in this case, just like we were in Walk the Line. It's always, what is it to be, Johnny Cash on stage? It's never from the audience perspective. It's always like, and in this case, what is it like to be in this insane little metal box with this crazy engine strapped to it? And what is Ken Miles? What is Christian Bale? How is he experiencing it? And we're always, the audience is always connected to what's happening to him emotionally, all the separate beats, and we always achieve that, achieved in the simple and classic way, because as you mentioned earlier, inspirations were films like Grand Prix and Le Mans, but more Grand Prix. I mean, so it's old school filmmaking, simple techniques, not, try to avoid as much CG, computer generated images as possible. We have very few that involve the racing. We have, some set extensions and crowds, but all the driving is all mechanical effects, and all, when you have a close up of Christian Bale in the car, all the cars you see next to him and in proximity, they're all being driven by race car drivers and stunt drivers, and it's all choreographed very precisely, and that really just like, Johnny Cash on stage, and him actually singing, and where the wide angle ends, physically present close to him, and we had the same approach with this. So, and no matter what the genre is and how we tackle it, it's always really about connecting to the characters with Mangold, and he's.
I've always been curious what your process is, even though, I mean, the age old is director setting the tone, or maybe you guys have such a shorthand, it's obviously collaborative, but I've always been intrigued by, say, Johnny Cash is what people could relate to, but the big emotions of you're on edge for a car race or whatever it is, how a cinematographer can look at something and say, I want to portray this emotion, and you're connected to, say, a color or a certain kind of light or a tone or a lens that is your way of representing that emotion. Can you share something like what that process is for you outside of what the director is telling you?
Well, it depends on each project is different. I mean, I connect to this period. I mean, with Mangold, we're very much in sync. I mean, we're kind of the same age. We both come from indie filmmaking. He comes from films like Heavy, and his father was a painter. I was a painter. We grew up watching or liking the same kind of film. So, there's this whole memory bank of things that connect us, and we're very much in sync in terms of how we respond to things. But this particular period, 60s, I mean, I grew up watching French New Wave. I was obsessed with cars and Alfa Romeos and all watching Godard films and watching Jack Palance and Brigitte Bardot drive one in the movie Contempt. So it's been a long, and I grew up in Europe. So I have a lot of images for this that are just embedded in somewhere in my brain. And, you know, I was very inspired. Normally, I don't really collect a lot of images to prepare for a film. But in this case, it was fun to also watch documentaries. There's a great documentary about this exact event called Go Like Hell. No, actually, sorry, 24 Hour Wars is a book called Go Like Hell. But there's also wonderful documentaries, 16 millimeter, where you see all the audience and all the, you know, gendarmes picnicking and all the little textures and colors around this event. You know, so there's a lot of inspiration there. But in general, with the way Mangold and I like to work is we don't preconceive too much. We like to see the actors on set with the set dressing, we're in that light situation and taking all the elements on the day of a shoot, block the scene, and then we really decide what the shot list is going to be and what the design of the lensing is. I mean, we do have, you know, we both feel like we're kind of have a classical approach. We're a bit old fashioned, you know, we don't become too energetic or overuse the camera movement. We do little subtle push-ins. We're both very much into composition, these wider lensing, staging, foreground, close-ups, even holding and relating of actors to the close-ups. So it's just something that we're, you know, we have a similar taste in. I mean, Every film can be made 100 different ways, and if you collaborate with a director, it's nice if you're actually, you know, have similar taste. It's just a matter of how do you want to tell a story. But this, you know, we like to see things happening, and then, you know, we don't really storyboard, we don't really even make a shot list. We rehearse the actors, and then they go back to hair and makeup, and we say, okay, we're going to do this and this and this and that, and we kind of feel it. And then that way you allow yourself the possibility to take advantage of things that happen that you can never design, you can never preconceive. You know, suddenly Matt Damon does something, you know, he starts playing with a wrench, and then, you know, that leads to this. And, you know, we're open to discovering these little moments that make a good movie, that make it different, that little looks and little connective tissues that you know you have to see right there when it happens. So but of course,
do you feel there was a point?
I mean,
oh, sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Do you feel there was a point in your career or a film that you kind of look back to, maybe that was kind of when you were able to step away from, like you said, you guys can play more and you kind of make it, you sound to me like you guys are more like jazz musicians, but I think there can be such a science to cinematography. So kind of maybe a point in films or in your guys' collaboration along the way where you kind of realized, hey, we maybe through Identity to Walk the Line to 3:10 to Humidor, like, hey, you know, this is, we can kind of not have to, in terms of making the day, what the AD needs, what the, you know, on the technical side, but to really be able to get in there and play. Was there a time where you really could just go off of instinct, kind of where you remember letting go for yourself as an artist?
No, I mean, you know, look, it's still a technical job. We still, you know, we're functioning within the studio system. There's a lot of money at stake, and, you know, but we can do that, but still be very responsible. I mean, Mangold is one of these people who can do these films that are, you know, kind of dinosaurs in the current. I mean, we're not doing superhero movies. We're not, but, you know, this movie cost a lot of money. It cost close to $100 million. So, I mean, we still have to function in that structure. We don't just wing it. And, but we're, you know, we're just kind of, because we're very much in sync, we think fast on our feet. We work. We had an amazing first assistant director, Adam Songer, who's worked with Spielberg a lot. I mean, he was very helpful in structuring the day. I mean, this film has a lot of the exterior, so it's all about how do you lay out the day, how do you work around the ever-changing light, and you know, you have to juggle all these elements, and all the drivers, the car breaking, this, that, it's a lot of things that, you know, can happen on a race car movie with vintage cars. I mean, we have to build all these. We build over 30 race cars. The one of the main goals was to, you know, convey speed. And of course, we're not Steve McQueen. We're not actually doing race speed, which he would, you know, put cameras on these 70s Porsches and go 200 miles an hour. So we were, trying to go as fast as we could, but safely and responsibly. It has a free flow element, but you know, we still function within our perimeters and our schedule and our days. And actually, Mangold is really conscious of that, and you know, we've never been on a film that's really gone over schedule or over budget. That's, you know, something we still manage to do.
Well, this sounds so simple, but I've always wondered, in terms of the little things other than what it's like working with someone or knowing their habits or getting along with someone, does something as simple as knowing, say, the skin tones of that you've worked with Matt Damon a few times, or you've worked with Christian Bale a few times, that knowing what works with their makeup, or, and not just, you know, their team or whatever, but the bare bones of lighting them, does it get down to where just stuff like that really eases your time along? I mean, you're so far into your craft, but for beginners and basics out there, I've always wondered if it gets down to, you know, that kind of stuff becomes helpful for a DP.
It certainly helps. I mean, Matt is a filmmaker himself. It's not like, oh, okay, we're dealing with some actor here and we have to treat him with, right, you know, gloves. I mean, first of all, any actor that's worked with so many great directors as him and Christian have, I mean, I've worked with George Clooney as an actor two times or three times as a director. You know, these guys are pros. It's definitely helpful to have actors on that, film actors, you know, on that caliber, from that caliber. And I mean, Matt is, you know, both Christian have incredible to work with. But yeah, I do know, you know, it helps knowing, you know, Matt maybe needs a little more of that, a little more makeup than this. Christian needs, you know, less of that. Clooney needs none, you know. It's definitely helpful, but knowing the people, I mean, there's a relationship there. It's very important for cinematographers to have a very good relationship with actors. And but, you know, when they're passionate, and also with, you know, when they feel like you know what you're doing and they feel like you're passionate about what you're trying to accomplish, even if it gets complicated, they really sympathize. They also want to get, you know, they nobody wants to give up on the shot, you know, and having failed. I mean, if we're going after something, you know, there's a scene in the movie where Christian Ken Miles is walking with his son down. It's actually in the trailer also. He walks down the runway at dusk, and we're at a landing, you know, at the airport, on a runway. I mean, in the movie, it's LAX, but we shot at Ontario Airport, but it's still an open airport, like a couple of runways over, planes are landing, and we had no time to set up gear. We also couldn't really set up any grip gear because airport authorities were like, the wind could pick it up and blow it out. You know, couldn't use any lights because it would distract or mislead the pilot. So we decided to do the scene
Wow.
after sunset, and it's a pretty, you know, it's an intimate scene where Christian Bale is walking with his son, Noah, and they talk about, you know, it's a philosophical discussion about what it means and the perfect line. And you know, we didn't really know exactly the blog. I mean, we knew we were going to walk, we were going to sit down at some point. And so I put the Oculus head, which is a stabilized head, on the Fisher dolly. And because I couldn't really lay track, I couldn't design anything. So we could just roll over the pavement and not require a track. And then I had Scott Tokimoto on the second camera on Steadicam and go, okay, you're going to get this. And we had a 20-minute window to do about 8 shots with dialogue with the child. And luckily we had our department had brought these numbers with that indicate runways, and we had a large number 8, and that put out some light. So I motivated light off of that. I had one sky panel. Otherwise, this, you know, they would have been completely silhouetted against the dusk sky, and it worked out great. But it was a real scramble. And but one of those things where, you know, it's beautiful when you actually accomplish it. I could have actually gone back the next day and completed it, but it was just like, let's just try and get it done. You know, it's like, it was a big thing with the airport, and it's like, let's just do it. And that when, you know, when you accomplish something like that, it's very satisfying. You know, but a few moments like that, and will be, because, you know, we're always dealing with losing the light, and there's a lot of late light and sunset-y shots and scenes. And I mean, there's another scene that just came out beautiful, but it was just a real scramble as the sun was setting in Mojave Desert. It's the last time we see Ken Miles drive, and you know, worked perfectly for the scene, the light and all that. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes you gotta get lucky.
That sounds so amazing. And I was born in Riverside, so I know the Ontario airport well, and those mountains and that area and the way some of those stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The sun is just so amazing coming in or out of funding, there.
Yeah, when Shelby got funding, he moved into a hangar at LAX. So, of course, we couldn't shoot LAX. So we went to Ontario airport, and we used this hangar where he had Shelby America and was really testing the cars. When the last plane left at LAX at 1 a.m., they would use the runways to, you know, for high-speed tests on their cars. And, you know, so we used Ontario Airport. So we were, you know, out there in Riverside. And then we painted in, I mean, 1CG element, of course, is the iconic LAX rest language. It's great.
So the main question is, and this is all over YouTube, so it's not a spoiler, because for audience and film buffs out there, the director James Mangold discusses the building of a stadium for the final race. And of course, you guys can YouTube that, because I'm interested in the relationship of yourself and a production designer with him saying you guys had to match, I think it was 5 or 7 locations in Atlanta with California, with the stunts. And so if there's any part of that good headache that you would to share?
Well, we shot mostly, we got lucky, you know, I mean, we shot mostly in California. I haven't done a movie in with my LA crew in a long time. We actually got a good chunk of the California rebate. So, but, you know, also, we build for Le Mans, which is, you know, in reality, in the 60s, it's a country road race in central France. So it has very lush green landscape, and, you know, there's long country roads like the Mulsanne Strait that leads to the hairpin turn at the end of it, which is really featured in our sequences. You know, there was no barriers, no safety. It was just tree-lined country road street that we didn't have in California. So we did split off and send a second unit that did just car-to-car and the driving shots in Georgia and on actual country roads, and they also used I'm not sure, but Atlanta Speedway or something. I mean, there's some tracks out there. We also built the iconic Dunlop Bridge. What we did in California is we built the entire start-finish line pit area, which is a very long set. You must have seen these images. I mean, in Le Mans, the drivers would line up and across their cars, race across the track and get in their cars. It's a running start and start the engines and pull out. And you know, of course, we recreated that in the film. And everything you see in that iconic shot is real. I mean, we built François Audry, the production designer. He built this probably 400-foot long set, which is all the pits, the Ferrari pits, the Ford pits, Porsche pits, and it's all the people you see in are real. All the 35 race cars that take off are real. There's no CG. The only thing that's CG is what's opposite, which are the grandstands, you know, which are filled with thousands of people. And of course, we can do that. But Olivier, the VFX supervisor, did a really amazing job integrating it into our light, and it looks all very natural. But that set was incredible. It's. I mean, I show photos of that all the time to people and to other colleagues because it was very impressive. And all the advertising signs, all the textures, you know, all the cars we had. I mean, these cars are so beautiful. Just having so many, you know, we build, like I said earlier, we build over 30 race cars. I mean, you know, these cars cost, in reality, they cost, you know, these Ferraris cost up to $45 million. Now, the Ford GT40s, you know, one just got auctioned off at 66, a third place car for 13 million euros. So, you know, we had to build them. I mean, they were still expensive, but like about 100 grand, I guess. But, you know, we abused them. We'd drive them hard and close to each other and hitting our camera cars and each other. And, you know, there's a, it rained and in 66, it rained at Le Mans at night. So we have a very extensive night rain sequence, which is very intense. And I gave yellow headlights to the Ferraris so you can identify them in the dark. And again, like I said, a lot of it plays from Christian, from Ken Miles' perspective. So you see in the rearview mirrors, the yellow lights, the red cars. It's all very graphic and abstract, and very, very pleased with that sequence. The night stuff looks really amazing. Yeah.
What I saw in the trailer was, and just from being well-schooled in your other work for years, not just following up to do this interview, I noticed, I mean, all artists, but I noticed you have such a keen, I'm always interested by artists of your experience. If this ever shuts off, and I don't mean personally in your personal life, but in your films that I've admired, like Walk the Line, you guys just nailed being on the road. I've driven around the country, San Francisco, yeah, the way you captured In Pursuit of Happiness, Nebraska. How do you, I mean, is there ever a place where just like you weren't there that long and you just, I mean, like you were saying you grew up in that time period, but like to make it look the way you did, and like you didn't grow up in a race car pit, your dad wasn't a driver, yeah, you didn't, like how do you ever like turn off, like to, yeah, where just every single second you're not pulling something in? I mean, how does, like, does it ever turn down for artists of your guys' level and caliber? I mean, I'm intrigued by that process.
Well, look, if you're inspired by it, I mean, I have been exposed to a lot of, I mean, first of all, I was born in 62. My dad was a rally driver in Greece. They were all into cars. You know, they drove old Porsches and Lotuses and Jaguar XK120s and E-Type. So, I mean, I was a kid, of course, but, you know, I own two like 1972 sports cars. I mean, it's just something I've always been interested in. You have old car magazines. I grew up as a kid looking at, you know, Rally Monte Carlo and drivers and Formula One. I mean, I watched Niki Lauda burn live on television when I was, 11 or 12. So, I mean, I was always into that. But it's you know, look, you just wrap yourself in. And sometimes, I mean, it's like Wim Wenders made a great Americana movie with Paris, Texas. You know, he's not even American. And everyone says, oh, it's capitalist.
Right, right.
You know, so sometimes it takes.
Laszlo Kovacs and Easy Rider.
Yeah, exactly. It sometimes it just takes a fresh eye to it, you know, to see things that are there, you know, in a different way, but capture it. I mean, I've never been to Hawaii before, and when we did Descendants, that came out, I remember so many people who live in Hawaii going, this is the first movie that actually captures what it's like to live in Hawaii. It doesn't glorify it. It's not, you know, beaches and the surf, and it's like, you know, it shows all aspects of life, which is not, you know, just glamorous. And and same in Nebraska. I mean, I've never been to the, you know, to that area. I mean, I did a
no
little
way
road trip with
I'm
Alexander
sorry
before we started.
No way, you've never been to Nebraska? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to sound rude. Really?
No, I actually have been to Omaha.
Are you kidding
before
me? Really? Like, really? Has a whole, you hadn't spent time in Nebraska? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound rude, but I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's in the center.
I didn't mean to sound like a Beatles fan.
Actually, Omaha was created as the exact halfway point between the two coasts. That's its geographical significance. But, but we did do a road trip. It was Alexander and I in his mom's car, and we drove from Montana, and we actually drove the route all the way down to Lincoln, Nebraska. And I would just, you know, that was my impression. I had my camera, I had a black and white film still camera, the House of Blood, it's sort of a white screen that I forget what it's called. Anyway, and I would take stills, and I was just amazed. Like, I would drive through these towns, and I would go, whoa, where are all the people? You know, it's like a population of 16,000, 12,000, 8,000. It'd be, you know, warm, nice afternoon, fall day. And, you know, if you drive through a little town in Italy, you see all these, you know, old men sitting in the piazza having coffee, kids playing around the fountain. It'd be nobody anywhere. I go to Alexander. I mean, he's obviously from there. I go, where are they? And he goes, I don't know. I guess they're inside watching television. So those were my first impressions. And I would take photos. And you know, but that feeling, that original first impression is what, you know, carried through for me visually in the film. And we have these wide graphic landscapes, these little figures. It's all about isolation, lack of communication, loneliness, the absurdity of, you know, that kind of life. So, you know, you just get it where you, it's all often sort of your first impression, your instinctive reaction to things. I mean, in this case, with these cars and everything, I mean, I knew the story. I really wanted to own a Ford GT. A GT40, if I could. I mean, to me, that was not hard to get inspired by this material. And again, Christian Bale, a lot of inspiration comes, like I said, you know, on set. And when you see Bale and transforming into Ken Miles and you know, both of them, their chemistry, it's a really, they have a great connection in this film. I mean, I just come off of Downsizing with Matt, and a very different kind of film. It was just, you know, that's what inspires you, seeing the performances. Tracy Letts is Henry Ford is fantastic. It's just a great cast, down to every bit part. And again, going back to Mangold, he's very good with actors, very good with fine-tuning there. His direction, it's just always spot on. So it's really, you know, inspiration comes from everywhere, from all these things. I mean, this screenplay,
well,
you know, it's pretty straightforward. It's not like, you know, it's not like, I can't really call it an art film. And I mean, it's, you know, it's, simple dialogue. It's not simplistic, but it's, you know, it's nobody gives any, you know, makes any complex statements. It's like, she's running hot. But you know, it's you feel the emotions, you feel the connection, you feel the love, the passion, and I think, you know, hopefully you'll find a wide audience, because, you know, they don't make these movies really. I mean, you know, they cost too much money. It's 2 40-year-old white guys. You know, there's no superheroes. Not really made for teenagers.
The doom right now, right?
You know, I think
the doom. 2 40-year-old white guys.
You know, so
that was something so great that your director friend James Mangold said was that it wasn't a sex, there wasn't an explosion every 10 minutes. And that was, you know, I feel like movies have become like the playoffs of baseball or something. Like,
yeah,
we just wait for November and we get good stuff. And then January, we're back to streaming and video on demand. Super Bowl's over.
Well, you know, what's great on this movie, it was one of the most sort of satisfying experiences watching with an audience, is they applaud in these office scenes. You know, when Ford is talking to Shelby, and I mean, it's just like, then they clap and they laugh. And all the dramatic scenes are really strong also. It's not like, oh, you're just waiting for the next race, you know. I saw it in Toronto at the festival, and I've been to a couple of screenings with a large audience. It's a real, like, they're really engaged, really involved. And they're like, you know, there's like a fourth, you know, a couple of scenes in Ford office where they're just like applauding. It's great. You know.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. I just missed this whole comic book boat. I mean, I have some friends that are in the effects field, and I only go to ones they work on, but I try.
And I mean, you know, my friend Wally Pfister, he did all the Chris Nolan Batmans, and you know, try to see them, but it's hard for me to get connected to them. And there's a reason I didn't do Wolverine and Logan with Mangold. Like, I kind of waited for him to get done with these. And it's not that I'm a snob. And I mean, I have kids, you know, they love these epic, want to see those films. I get it. I understand why people are making them. I understand they make money. But, you know, to me, the filmmaker is just, I've done it. I did The Huntsman, you know. I mean, I've done it, but I just don't get the same, you know, watching Bruce Dern like sit on the sidewalk and talk about something with his son. I mean, it's like, and just pushing into this close up and his face and his white hair and saying something like, I failed you, my kids. And there's nothing like that, you know, when you hit these moments. And, you know, it's, to me, I mean, look, I mean, I'm sure people are very excited about making, I don't want to name any specific movie, but to me, it's, I don't feel the same way going to work in the morning, you know, like rigging some kind of cable rig and then flying a guy in tights, you know, across buildings. I mean, it's just like, I wouldn't go to work the same way.
you guys cannot CGI. I've seen it so many times, but I saw it 2 nights ago again when Will Smith is told he has the job in Pursuit of Happiness. I don't know if you were operating or who was, but the way you hold on him about to cry, no CGI on the planet could capture just that moment. I mean, for any of us who have remotely achieved anything or just on the smallest level of anything, just that, like, I mean, that's just, you can't get that. I mean,
well, that's you know, I was just talking to somebody the other day, and I go, the most amazing thing is for me working on movies is like, I was in India in the Himalayas somewhere in the remote Kashmir region scouting a movie. And this guy, like, he was like, what do you do? I go, I work on movies. So I'm a cameraman. Oh, yeah, really? Like, anything I would have seen? And I don't know. I did this, you know, this Sideways. It's about, oh, yes, about Melo. And, you know, and, oh, I love it. You know, and it's so funny when he says I had to run through the ostrich farm naked, you know. And I'm somewhere, you know, I mean, just to get that is so much more in a rewarding than anything else. I mean, it's like it really connects people and pursues happiness and, you know, and Sideways and Descendants and, you know, it's just, it connects to people. And I don't want people coming to me and go, oh, that looked amazing. Oh, I love the way that movie looked. I want to have him go, oh, it's so funny when, you know, Paul Giamatti, like, drinks a bucket of spit wine, you know. Because it means I connected to them. It meant something. It doesn't have to be, you know, a 360 Steadicam shot that, you know, goes for 10 minutes. You know, it's like, what moments do they remember? What connects to them? So,
that's really, it was so much fun. The question I always close with any guest, if you're up for two more quick questions, is I try to find out, is there, you know, stories in place, script is in place, you have the director you want, et cetera. Is there a dream genre that you would love to do before you hang it up, so to speak?
I mean, I feel fortunate. I got to do a Western, which is great. I got to do a black and white, actually, you know, although it was low budget, but it's technically a black and white studio movie. I got to do my 60s race car movie. I just want to do good movies. People ask me, what kind of movies do you feel like you want? No, a good movie. I want to work on good movies. I want to. I don't really care. It doesn't have to be. I haven't really done, Victorian or. But you know, The Favorite was something I liked, but I didn't like it because it was set in that period. It's actually not really, you know, it's much more contemporary anyway. Yeah, just looking for good, not even stories, just good characters. And I do like dark comedies. I hope I get to do a few more with Alexander. They're not always the most visual. I mean, Sideways, it's pretty simple in a way, but I just saw it again, and that's almost 18 years ago. It really holds up, just like The Big Lebowski. I watch him, and there's always something, you know, I rediscovered them, and I go, that just kind of works, as simple as it is. And we'd like to do more of those, you know, not looking for the next Lawrence of Arabia, although, I mean, I am a cinematographer, would have loved to work with David Lean and Kubrick and do Barry Lyndon and Lawrence of Arabia. But ultimately it's, you know, like one of my favorite movies is Dr. Strangelove. Again, you know, not, it's pretty contained, but it's, you know, it's Peter Sellers doing amazing things as multiple characters. So that's kind of what I remember. It's not, you know, it's funny that some of my favorite movies in history, film history, of that have affected me or the most are non-visual epics. Although Lawrence of Arabia definitely is, you know, a lot of them are smaller, more intimate stories.
400 Blows is something that I really loved when I saw it in college.
Well, of course, yeah.
And you're talking about the French.
The casting tape of Jean-Pierre Léaud when Truffaut picks him is amazing. If you can find that on YouTube, it's like, you know,
thank you for that.
And he interviewed, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of kids. And I mean, this kid was really like, I mean, he really was like that kid, was like a troubled kid. And I mean, that was an amazing find. And then, you know, he kept Jean-Pierre Léaud. First, he became his cinema, his alter ego in all these films.
Yeah, Bed and Board, Stolen Kisses, Love on the Run. Yeah. I always tell people, I said, you got to find those five films. TCM ran them one night. I showed my mom and she got to see them all five in a row for the first time. I said, you got to understand how lucky you are. I said, this is like, you know, you take an archaeology class and find Jimmy Hoffa. Like, I mean, it just doesn't get this good. I said, I've been looking for 15 years, like for the second one. the last question is
no, of course. I'm glad you've seen them all, because I'm always surprised when I talk to film students. I go, have you seen this? Have you seen, you know, Console Coupe? Have you seen? I can't believe that they haven't seen so many films. And I go, have you seen, you know, 8 1/2 or Amicorder, or have you seen? They haven't seen. I'm not even saying Pasolini or something like Kurosawa films. And okay, I go, okay, hold on. I'm going to make a list of 10 movies right now. And I go, I don't care what happens, but those 10 you have to like watch. And then when you watch them, come back and I'll give you some more. But it's sad in a way. But I mean, and I'm talking about, you know, film students in pretty big established film schools, you know, unless they have, you know, sometimes they have, you know, a teacher that really emphasizes that and then makes them watch the classics. But, you know, a lot of them just want to do a spec called commercial, come out of film school, you know, start working as a commercial director and make money, you know, which I get it. I mean, I want to make money. I mean, I'm happy when I do the movies I like, and I also get compensated for. I mean, it is the film industry we work in. So, but it's sad in a way that, like you were telling your mom, like, you know, it takes a lot of effort these days to find these, and without guidance, it's you know, it's a lot of work, you know, discovering all these gems.
I really wonder what's going on in the film classes. I was just fortunate that my grandma, before I went to film school, I graduated in 2001, that she would just be like, go watch all these Woody Allen films. Go watch these Hitchcock films. Yeah. Go watch Billy Wilder. Go watch David Lean. And so when I went to film school, same thing, like you said, no snob, but it was that Fincher, Paul Thomas Anderson era, which I love Boogie Nights, but it's pretty much what most people wanted to talk about. And I was just like, I want to talk about The Apartment and Fight Club. I want to talk about Some Like It Hot and Boogie Nights. It's all good. Like, nothing's right or wrong, like you were saying, but it's like, I'm, you know, what do you think? The Apartment's cool too. But yeah, I really wonder what goes on.
Yeah. I mean, of course. Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with the other ones, but it's like, you've got to also see these. And I mean, Hal Ashby, like, you know.
Hal Ashby, you brought up Hal Ashby. Go ahead.
You know, you gotta see. You gotta. I mean, you can't be into film and have, you know, not have seen Harold and Maude, or I mean, you just gotta, or The Last Detail, and you know. And I feel fortunate, because even with Alexander, I kind of feel he's maybe a contemporary Hal Ashby. You know. You know, or Bob Fosse, and I mean, it's just like, I wish, anyway, whatever, we can go on forever. I don't know.
No, well, I mean, as I say, you brought up Hal Ashby. I said, I hope your schedule is clear. No. I mean, Coming Home is one of my favorites. And for people out there, there's a great Hal Ashby documentary called Hal on Prime. And you know what you're saying about what people do nowadays is that, like on Netflix, I saw they had Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, then Mean Streets. And I was like, okay, no more excuses. It wasn't that you couldn't find it. It wasn't the library didn't have it. Like, there you go. Netflix has Mean Streets. You there should you see go. It. Don't get me wrong.
And before then Todd Phillips watched it, and he just made $90 million last weekend. So...
Right.
Well, you know, I mean,
go somewhere.
You watch The Joker. I mean, visually, I mean, speaking about cinematography, I mean, you know, it's the Dexters, the period, the cars. I mean, it's so heavily influenced by Taxi Driver. I mean, it's really well done. I thought it was like, you know, yeah.
Interesting. But, I love Michael Chapman's work.
Yeah, Michael Chapman. Last detail I saw a restored 16mm print of that, and it's just fantastic. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, you saw? Oh, okay, well,
started with Alexander in Toronto. Alexander's a big, big fan of Last Detail. He says he watches it like once a year when he can. He also watches like Paper Moon once a year when he can. We watched Paper Moon when we did Nebraska, when we did the DI and the, you know, Added Grain, and it's amazing. You project. We saw a film projection. You put something like that up. You know, my kids are 11. They've never seen a film projection. You know, it's so alive, and the projector movement in the gate, and then the projector flicker and the grain, and it's you know, most young people would probably think something's wrong. It's like the mistake.
You know? I saw Nebraska, that you don't think so. It's clicking. The closing shot of Nebraska, I thought of Paper Moon when I saw it. I thought of the truck driving away and them following it down the hill. And but yeah, I mean, Peter Bogdanovich, Last Picture Show, What's Up Doc, and those I all saw in a row at Blockbuster had them. So I was just fortunate like that. I guess I'll actually wrap up there. There's no need for my last question, because as I can tell, we have a good while before one of us decides it's time to go. So I wanted to, again, thank you for your time. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a real joy talking to you.
My pleasure. Always a joy talking to a film lover, and it's, you know, somebody who's passionate about cinema. And I hope we'll have many people who remain that way, and they don't just view things on the iPhone. I mean, I'm concerned for my children, and I try to. I made them watch The Man Who Would Be King the other day, and I said, if you need to go to the bathroom, I'm gonna pause it. You're gonna come back. You know, it's Michael Caine, Sean Connery. Right. It's to me the greatest adventure movie, like and you're gonna watch it, and it's, you know, it takes a while to build the characters. It's slow going, but, and you know, it's just nice to see that it still works. You just, they, you know, the way they're used to taking in information and at a different pace right now, it's like you gotta let them, you know, I mean, we develop characters at a different pace. So you watch Godfather 1, it's 40 minutes at this wedding.
Oh.
And nothing really happens. Ooh. And but what happens is you get to know every player in the movie and where they stand in relationship to each other. Oh, this is the, you know, the brother who's really, you know, this is the mom, and this is the guy behind the desk who's in charge. Anyway. And then, you know, then you can start moving the story. But why can you do it? Because you spend this time of, you know, introducing these things and introducing these people. And it's just hard for a new generation, because, you know, I watch these Pixar movies, and I get invited to Pixar to talk to the animators. And I go, just because you can move the camera everywhere doesn't mean you need to constantly be doing 360s and flying around, like, and the sound is overstimulated, and it's like, I can keep it simpler. you know, but it's very hard to, you know, it's kind of hard for them to take in a movie that is not so stimulating. You know, it's just, that's what they've come to expect. But it's nice when you see a classic movie connect to, you know, generation that was born 50 years after the making of some film. So, I mean, I have hope that cinema, and, you know, well, you're a great example. I mean, you're, you know, I don't know how old you are, but,
I'm 40. I'm 40,
yeah. So you're 17 years younger than I. So there's, you know,
I was just lucky. I was just my grandpa and my grandma and my mom just being very liberal and sense of history and just watch this. And, you know, I was really lucky. I couldn't imagine, like, if right now I was saying, huh, what's Rashomon, huh? Point of view in a movie, what? Like, that would trip me out. I don't know. I have to think about that. I really have to think about that. I didn't know what Rashomon was. If you said Rashomon and I had to look it up, I might stop my show. not to be dramatic as you push in. Sorry.
Keep your show going for a while.
Thank you. Well, right. Enjoy where you're at and your travels and safe filming and all that stuff.
Thank you so much. I'm actually in Chicago starting the trial of the Chicago 7 set in 68, 69. Aaron Sorkin directing, and so I kind of leave off where Ford versus Ferrari, that was 66, so now I'm at 68. So it's a continuation, a slightly different world, but we got, you know, Chicago cops beating up hippies in Grand Park. So it's, but still, visually,
that sounds like fun.
It's nice to stay in the 60s, though. That's what I'm doing now.
We had we had Charlotte Christensen on for Molly's Game, so so Sorkin directing is something we're a fan of for sure.
Yeah, this is his second movie, Molly's Game, being as a director, of course.
Enjoy that. Well, congrats to you.
Thank you. All right. Okay.
All right, you have a good night.
Catch you next time.
All right. Take care.
You have a good night. All right. Bye. Cheers. Bye-bye.
All right. That was a wonderful talk about Ford versus Ferrari with Faden Papamichael, ASC, GSC, Oscar nominated for Nebraska. Wonderful film talk as well. As always, I'm hyper spaz excited mode because I just had a great film talk. But that's going to do it for me as I head off to the dinner table to recharge and maybe watch some more movies tonight. All right. You know what time it is, whether it's afternoon, morning, or evening, make sure and watch a good movie. Ford v. Ferrari, coming out November 15th. Aloha.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Pictures Podcast, real conversation and movie-induced inspiration.